This is American Fashion Podcast. I'm Charles Beckwith here in the Mouth Media Network studio in Chelsea, New York City. And I'm here with Mark Heuer, who is a professor at Susquehanna University. Hi, Mark.
Hello, Charles. Glad to be here.
And I'm also here with Sarah Jastrom, who is a professor at the Hamburg School of Business Administration in Germany. And Zara, I'm sorry, how
Berberian.
Berberian.
Exactly.
Who is a doctoral student at the Hamburg School of Business Administration and also an ethical fashion expert. All three of you are ethical fashion experts, in fact, and two of you have written books about them, and one of you has an essay in one of those books, so I think we're good on the ethical fashion front for this episode. Mark, what's the title of your book?
Charles, the title of the book that I co-edited along with Carolyn Becker-Leifold is Eco-Friendly and Fair, Fast Fashion and Consumer Behavior.
And is this a textbook or is this an academic work? Do you feel like this is an accessible thing for lots of our listeners to listen to, or is this something people use in a classroom?
It's intended for practitioners, as well as perhaps using it in an academic setting. It has a number of different chapters that could be used as case studies. So it can apply to both practitioners and an academic audience.
And Sarah, what's the title of your book and what's it all about?
Hi, Charles. Our book is called Sustainable Fashion, Governance and New Management Approaches. I have been editing it together with Anna Maria Schneider of the German Ministry for Development. And it's actually similar. It's also a book that targets practitioners as well as academics, I would say. Basically, any kind of stakeholder that is interested in the topic of sustainable fashion. And it is an edited volume, so it has many different chapters. And some chapters are maybe a bit more academic. Others are more like case studies from firms. So we have authors from H&M, for example, and firms like that, or Otto, Chibo, some of also the famous German firms in the field of sustainability, but also academic actors or actors from ministries in Germany and also from international organizations.
So we describe American Fashion Podcast as a series of deep dive interviews, but these are really deep dive books into sustainability and how to really have a practice within it and understand the big concepts. And they're very recent books. You've published these in the last year, right?
Yes, the book that I co-edited just came out in the middle of May, and I was fortunate enough to just launch it at the Academy of Management meeting last week. So it is very new.
And you teach management at Susquehanna University.
That's correct. I teach management and, of course, had a full corporate career before that. So that's correct. I teach at the Sigmund Y. School of Business at Susquehanna.
Okay. I noticed something in your book, Sarah, that you kind of pointed to China and Bangladesh within the ethical fashion conversation have now become Myanmar and Ethiopia. That once again, the fashion industry has said, okay, it's too expensive here and gone somewhere else. And we kind of thought that it was near the end of the road. And Myanmar's a big surprise because, I mean, that's a military dictatorship. And there are, I mean, human slavery and human trafficking is major there. That is a massive center for that. It's, you know, on the order of North Korea in terms of how open that government is. So did the fashion industry not learn? Or is it, I mean, it seems like it's still the same playbook. They've hopped to yet another place where they can really exploit people.
I think it's probably not possible to give a general answer, because of course there are some, it's not that the whole fashion industry is in Bangladesh or the whole fashion industry is like moving from Bangladesh to Myanmar or Ethiopia. So these are of course certain brands and certain players. And yes, I mean, I think the cost reduction motive is still very prevalent in the fashion industry. And there is also a lot of pressure on purchasing managers to keep reducing the cost, and the competitive environment is very tough, especially in the fast fashion industry. And I think this is why still even though all of us would certainly agree that textiles and fashion should be produced under high ethical standards. But yeah, you still see, of course, a lot of different behavior in that industry. Still, I would say it's still the main parts of the industry that are that are still very cost driven and not so much. I don't know, or it doesn't seem as if they are not much driven by ethical considerations, but it's, yeah.
So do you think the new compliance standards are having an impact on how fashion is made, or are these merely decoration?
What exactly do you mean when you say new compliance standards?
Well, the UN guiding principles for business and human rights that are now being pushed into the NAPs, the National Action Plans in Europe, things like that.
I would again say that there is no general answer to this. I think it can, I mean, it's possible to sort of communicate such standards in your on your web page and still behave in a different manner as a firm. In some cases, it's possible. Some other organizations are quite radical with that. Like, for example, if you think about GOTS, for example, as a very high level standard for ethical fashion, I think they are very radical with regard to misuse. I actually saw it on the Ethical Fashion Fair in Berlin once, that if a firm would use that label and they are not like properly registered with the organization, some people would go to that firm and even cut out the label from their billboard that they had there, for example. So I think it's there is maybe still some greenwashing going on, but it's also depending on which firm you're looking at, of course, and not all firms are the same and not all brands are behaving the same. And I think also not all standards are suitable for greenwashing. Some you can more easily use for greenwashing, and others there are more stricter controls with regard to how you actually behave and whether you actually adhere to a certain standard.
What is GOTS? Where is that based?
GOTS is it's the Global Organic Textile Standard. I hope I got it right here. Where is it based is a good question I cannot answer, but it's an international standard for high quality of the fabrics with regard to chemicals and so on that are in the fabrics, and it also involves high standard with regard to labor rights and so on. And the organization, I could not tell you now top of my mind where it is based, but it is a very internationally recognized standard for let's say sustainable fashion.
I don't think I've seen that on many clothing tags. Are large brands adhering to that standard, or is it very popular yet?
Yes, you don't see it so often because the standards, the requirements are so high. So this is why you don't see that very often. I'm sure you have a lot of certificates here in the US as well, and GOTS is an international.
No one can keep track of them.
Yes, exactly.
There's a bunch of companies that give certificates out, and we're not sure what any of them
do. And then some of them are like maybe more easy to get, and you can more easily comply with them, and others are maybe more difficult to get. And GOTS is you find it if you visit fair trade fairs or shows, most sort of consequent firms would apply this label and buy fabrics that are GOTS labeled, for example.
Okay.
And this is, but because the requirements are very high with regard to the quality of the fabrics and also production processes, and this is why you don't find this in every department store here so often, but you increasingly also see it with bigger brands that are also using this. For example, in Germany we have a big coffee roaster, Chibo, that is also offering some textiles in their coffee shops, and some of them are GOTS labeled, for example. You find it quite often on children's clothes, because consumers seem to care more when they purchase clothing for their children, and they care more about whether there are any chemicals inside and such things. Whilst when they buy from them for themselves, they are maybe a little less careful sometimes.
So would this be equivalent to like the LEED standard for building construction? LEED silver, LEED gold, LEED platinum, where they're certifying how sustainable the building is and
I don't know what exactly the LEED standard includes. Okay. So actually, when you look at GOTS, it is quite a detailed document of like it lists very exactly certain what is all not allowed and so on in a in a product. So I would say it's difficult to compare it directly, probably. And
it sounds like they're very similar because that's also a very ordered process for certifying new construction and rehabilitated buildings and that sort of thing. Mark, in your book and in Sarah's book, the term fast fashion is used a lot. And it seems like in every essay within the books, fast fashion gets redefined. And people define fast fashion in different ways. Is that term useful anymore? Does it mean what it did 10 years ago?
I would say generally yes, in the sense that fast fashion is equal essentially to the make, take, waste paradigm of an environment where there's a very fast change in styles, and it's marketed in a way that that the prices are low, so you have kind of a cheap chic type environment in the stores where people are marketed to in a way, well, if you don't come and get it today, then it's never going to be there for you, and so there's a marketing environment where it kind of plays upon the self-esteem of people, and to me that's kind of common to all of the definitions of fast fashion. So what we're looking at really is the whole make, take, waste paradigm, and how can that be addressed?
Can you break that down? What's make, take, waste?
Yeah. In other words, making a clothing item at a very low cost being able to market it in a way that's very attractive in terms of constantly bringing in new styles. So rather than having three cycles of fashion in a year, as here you'll now have 8 or 10, where you're constantly turning the inventory very quickly, you're bringing in new items that have just come from the catwalk, basically, and so you're getting people to come in and take those items because they've been drawn in, they've been pulled in to buy them because it applies to a vision of who someone wants to be, perhaps. The marketing's very good. So that's the take part. And then the waste part is because the items are cheap and they're price-wise, and because they are not made well, quite often with synthetic items, they typically don't last very many washings or dry cleanings, and typically people, because they didn't pay much for them, they're willing to throw them out quite quickly. And one of the things I think we focused on in the chapters was how quickly or how little people will pay attention to recycling or reusing these items as a result. So the waste part of it becomes a really major part of it. There's very little circularity in the items. And I know Zara has talked quite a bit about how do we manage the waste recycling reuse part of it in the book that in the chapter that she wrote for my book. So does that help?
Yeah, yeah. Okay, can you talk about that, about the circularity and what's going on with companies trying to make sure things don't go out and go into a landfill?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so actually there are very different business models and companies that introduce different business concepts of how to increase this recycling and how to decrease the waste. So for example, there are different, like for example, there is a brand, Swedish brand called Filippa K, and this brand has introduced the concept, they have their own second-hand store, and you can just, the items that you are not going to use anymore, you can just go and like just bring them back, and they will just store it in their secondhand store, and anyone who would like can just buy the same item for the secondhand store.
That's fantastic.
Yeah. There are also other platforms that, for example, you just go online and you personalize the clothes that you would like to wear. They do not have any storage. They do not have like, so they do not have any waste. So you just personalize what you are going to wear and just they make it on demand. So this is another like way of decreasing the waste of companies so that they just produce what you want to buy.
Interesting. When fast fashion came about as a term, they also said the democratization of fashion, and that people will be able to choose things more freely, and everyone will have access to everything. But that really wasn't true. It was a lie that the high quality goods were always going to be out of reach for most people. Has there been a consumer backlash to fast fashion in that way? Do we see people making different choices now that they realize what it is, or is this cycle still continuing?
I'll address that quickly. All three of us had the opportunity to attend the New York City Fair Trade Coalition meeting last night, and what we learned there were all the myriad of ways that young entrepreneurs are providing alternatives to fast fashion. And so the idea here is among people who have bothered to understand the fact that the fast fashion industry and textiles in general is the second most polluting industry in the world after oil and gasoline, that there are other ways of doing it. So I think there is definitely a bubbling up, if you will, of eco fashion. And if you go back just 5 years and look where eco fashion was and where it is now, you see, I think, a real kind of generational shift towards understanding the value of having, as Zara was talking about, personalized fashion, items that you can have fewer items, but ones that really represent your tastes and you can wear many, many more times.
Yeah, it's. I wonder whether, I mean, because Sarah is also doing research on this topic, or we are doing it together, and I would say yes, some sort of generational shift is there. But when you look at the like volume of ethical fashion that is being sold, it's still a very small niche market, unfortunately. So I wouldn't be that optimistic as you just sounded. It is actually her PhD topic to find out what are actually the barriers and why is there a gap between the fact that many young people now wear these t-shirts with these political logos on it and phrases on it, and there seems to be a lot of some sort of movement towards sustainability, but why is the ethical fashion market growing so slowly? That's actually her research focus.
What have you found out so far?
So actually, I found out that there are very different factors, consumer-related and product-related, that create this gap between consumers' positive attitudes and their actual behavior. So for example, consumers are more eager to buy products that are more that are cheaper, and they perceive ethical fashion to be more expensive. So they also perceive ethical fashion to be of lower quality and not easily available. Also not convenient to access it because you need additional time and effort. Moreover, consumers find very difficult to control their habits because they're already used to consuming this traditional, like, fast fashion stuff.
That makes sense. Yeah. I noticed in both of the books references to Germany and the impact of Rana Plaza. And I was wondering, does Germany lead the EU more than economically? Is it pushing for a lot of these new regulations and policies?
I think my friends in Germany would like if I say yes. And I think, yeah, I could actually say yes. I mean, leading the EU. There's certainly a lot going on in Germany on this topic. And the German Minister of Development Aid, Mr. Müller, has initiated textile partnership, or I think the correct term is Partnership for Sustainable Textiles, in German Textilbündnis, where the initiators aim to create a movement in the whole German textile industry. And a lot of actually German brands became members of that partnership, and they all are trying to agree on certain standards that they like to implement throughout their whole supply chains. And as you can imagine, it's a complicated process and a lot of negotiation and a lot of maybe different opinions on what are the right standards and what are the right measures to demonstrate compliance with the standards and so on. But there is certainly a big movement in Germany currently going on, and it's also internationalizing. Also the Dutch government is very active in this field. This is from the political side. And of course there are also many brands actually. Some are even faster than the political actors. So I have the feeling that a lot of movement is also coming from the brands, such as Tchibo or Otto. They are very big German brands and firms that are front runners in the field of sustainability, I would say. But also we also have very many interesting startups, like for example Mellerware. That's a startup that came from Lüneburg in the north of Germany, and they have developed a business model where they are where all of the products are fully complying with cradle to cradle principles. So they also have similar backpacks than the one that Mark has, and they go they are fully integrated in the cradle to cradle circle, and so every material has its place in the circular economy there, and is recyclable and recycled and such things. And we have been demonstrating such and showing such examples here in our book. So there is a lot going on, I would say, but probably also in a lot of other countries. I think in UK there's also a big movement and a lot of influential brands there, and Scandinavian countries anyway. So I don't know whether Germany is really leading, but I think we also have something to say, and to show.
For our listeners who don't know, what is cradle to cradle?
It's basically the idea that you are trying to everything that, like in terms of materials that you use, let's say in a production process, creates first of all not much waste, and if you have waste, you try to give it back into a circular system where out of that waste that is part of your production process, you can use it again and try to create a circle in terms of it's difficult to explain it in English. Maybe I should start again. So what is cradle to cradle? It's the idea that that you have a circular process of how you use your resources that are part of production and product development. So you're trying to start with recycled materials, for example, that are the basis for your production and the products that you are creating, and then all the waste that is a part of any production process is then used again to create new products again. So it's basically a lot about recycling, but also about creating, as I said, less waste and make use of materials again in different formats, basically.
So it's like when people go camping and they don't leave anything, they don't damage it, they leave the place the way they found it when they leave, right?
Yeah, or you use your waste again to create a fire, for example, and that creates energy, and you can cook your food on it and so on. And in a simple way, yes.
This conversation has taken a strange turn. We're now we're cooking food by heating our waste. It's
yeah, I mean, not the plastic waste, hopefully, but yeah.
Yeah. Oh, okay. The material waste.
Okay.
Different conversation. So globally, who's to decide our responsibilities? I mean, the US and the EU have different political and bureaucratic cultures. The UK is trying to pull out of the EU over some of the overreach policies that a lot of people there felt were coming from the EU. It doesn't seem likely that the US will join with so many restrictions anytime soon. Have you been observing much of this, Mark? Do you have a feeling about this?
Yes, of course. There's the U.S. is at a particular point in time where we have become more isolationist, obviously. We don't know how long that period of time will last. But as it relates to the fashion industry, particularly the supply chain that's at work currently, we have one of the big problems why issues like Rana Plaza occur is that there's very little governance in the developing countries such as Bangladesh or Cambodia, Vietnam, where the fast fashions are being produced. And this is something that we have been looking at, Sarah and I, in separate research. And so as a result, there, you know, the EU, the US, et cetera, kind of work through the WTO, the World Trade Organizations, in terms of determining what types of subsidies should be available and where. That has some influence. But beyond that, there's very scant governance once you get to these countries, because the governments in Bangladesh, for example, are quite often corrupt, and in fact many of the people in the government also own the factories. So this is why we have a situation where I think the three of us here believe that we kind of need to change consumer buying patterns as a way to influence change, because the normal ways of adapting regulations, et cetera, are outside of the realm of what's possible, because there just is not a government to implement those changes.
Are there any indications that any company's approach to marketing has had some impact in terms of changing consumer behavior that would indicate that could be done at a large scale globally? Has anybody had little successes that point to the possibility of much larger successes?
That's a really interesting question, and I would have to be honest that I can't point to empirical evidence that large fashion retailers have really been focused on doing what you're suggesting. Perhaps Sarah or Zara can comment on that more. I think in my view, I think a lot of what we hear tends to be greenwash. And so I would ask the other two if they, I tend to be kind of skeptical of corporate marketing on what they are doing to change when this is frankly how they, this very model is how they satisfy their shareholders.
Actually, there are many companies that are doing a lot of stuff to make consumers aware of ethical fashion consumption and of the problems that their consumption decisions are causing to the environment, to communities, and to humans. So, for example, there is a very interesting company. It's called Mud Jeans, and this company enables customers to rent jeans. So, actually, you are not buying your pair of jeans, but you are just renting it. So, whenever you just get tired of it, you are just getting it back. So actually, you are not throwing away what you do not like anymore, but you are just giving it back so that anyone who is interested can just come and rent it again. Or, for example, these second-hand stores that you can just get back, like, give back your the clothes that you are not wearing anymore to the fashion brand, and it just places it in a second-hand store, is also another concept that makes consumer aware of how they themselves can make their own contribution to ethical fashion consumption and to the less waste.
So this is this whole concept of collaborative fashion consumption.
That is what Samira Iran has introduced in our book, and it's basically an like a broader term for different sorts of collaborative ways of consumption, meaning sharing clothes, swapping clothes, renting it. So there are different sort of, she defines in our book, different subversions of what she calls collaborated fashion consumption, or that you meet with your friends to repair your clothes, for example, in cafes or...
The repair cafes are amazing. I love this concept.
Yeah, something
I wish we had them in New York.
You could start one.
Yeah. I don't think I have time.
If you are able to repair clothes.
Well, it's the concept of repairing clothes or repairing your laptop and having a place to go where the tools are there and there's someone who can guide
don't
you.
Don't you have this here at all?
I don't think so.
It's quite popular.
I mean, we have maker spaces, but that's a different thing. That's kind of a membership organization thing.
Okay.
Yeah. It's not really here yet.
Mm-hmm.
I'd love to have more of that sort of thing
that's
here.
That's interesting. We have something in Germany that's not yet in New York.
Yeah, that is interesting. but actually, I think quite a bit is going on in Europe in terms of the reuse paradigm. And in fact, in one of the chapters in the book that I co-edited talks about, you know, the lost art of mending, and how that's can be that's something that could be brought back. I remember as a child mending socks.
Yes.
That's something people don't do anymore.
Yeah.
So I guess
it's
when going back to the question you asked me about whether or not there's any bubbling up of change, I think for example, you talked earlier about all the different codes that are out there. There's so many of them. There's a cacophony of codes that we hear about. There's so much you can't cut through the noise of it. There's that, and there's also processes that are either being reborn or collaborative processes that are coming about. And I think these are processes that need to kind of mature before we see the permanent change. So this is why I'm hopeful, but I'm an old sales guy, so I always look at things as being half full. Why I think there's reason to have hope. I just don't think corporate America is interested in it because it's not a way to cash in on profit right now this quarter.
Do you see PLM technology, product lifecycle management software, where they're starting to track the supply chain and the consumer behavior a lot more closely in a holistic way? Do you see that driving any change yet?
Well, there's certainly the whole issue of provenance that's out there, and there has been the maturing of RFID technology that allows provenance to be tracked, and so it is growing. And I know there are large corporations that have integrated it into their inventory management process. So I don't think that it has really taken off the way it should. I think one of the problems that we have in the supply chain is there just simply is not enough transparency. And when there's not enough transparency, that means codes that Sarah was talking about are not going to be complied with. So I would say, yes, there's a shortfall there, as you're talking about, and a lot of it goes back to transparency and provenance.
Yeah, there is a whole debate about transparency and traceability in fashion supply chains, where some people argue that if the consumer knows more about where exactly the clothes are coming from, then she or he would be more sort of be more able to decide in a in an ethical manner, let's say, or decide based on ethical considerations when purchasing fashion. I'm actually quite skeptical about it. I mean, normally I would also say I'm also an optimistic person like you, but we're having this debate also. HSBA is a business school that is also very much interested in the whole topics of digitalization and innovation and blockchain and such things. And it's always, and we have an article of Robin Cornelius in our book about how you can with certain QR codes trace back the textiles to their place of origin, and when you have a certain you just use a certain barcode and then you find out in which factory in Bangladesh this t-shirt was produced and what are the standards there and how far did it travel and so on. I mean, we have this also in other products for other product categories. I'm not so sure whether it really whether many consumers are so interested somehow in it or whether it really would have a big influence, because so far you rather see that many consumers are also suffering from some sort of information overkill. And so there is this hypothesis that increased transparency or traceability would lead to more conscious consumption, as if it was an automatic causal relationship.
I've written about this quite a bit, and the advantage of using a blockchain. I mean, lots of people try to apply a blockchain to any business model, when you could just use a database. But in this case, the blockchain makes a lot of sense, because you can see how much the sewer was paid. If you look back at the history of the transactions for the garment that you have in your hands that is traceable, you can see that garment worker only made 68 cents an hour for 2 hours to make the sweater that you're paying $300 for. And that doesn't make sense.
Yes, and of course.
If people, but has it been proven at all that people will care?
I mean, it's not that we don't know these things today without blockchain. I mean, everybody could know these things. We have a lot of documentaries, and everybody knows it, that workers in textile factories very often earn almost nothing.
A lot of people think that it's robots making their clothes right now, and that's just not true yet.
I can confirm this. This is also what some of my students sometimes think. I mean, this information, as you have just described it, of course, these are highly competitively relevant information for firms. So far, I don't know any firm using blockchain in that sense that you would.
No, it's all experimental still. Mm-hmm,
that you would really find, for example, wages there.
Yeah.
Some people do this tracing, like with this QR code that I just mentioned, just to trace back the country of origin. But of course, many firms are also very careful with blockchain, because some firms don't want to name their suppliers, because this is competitively relevant information. The suppliers will probably not like to put the exact numbers on the wages that they are paying. So, I mean, this what you describe is like perfect transparency of all these things that matter. And I'm very skeptical whether you really would find such information there, because there is a strong contra interest on the corporate side, because this is all highly, as I said, competitively relevant information. And as I also said before, it's not a secret that workers earn almost nothing in textile factories. And people like to ignore that in the purchasing situation, when they just see a nice dress for the party in the evening. They just blank this sort of information that they have.
Well,
Charles,
your book's about this. So what do you think, Mark?
I think part of this certainly goes back to the topic that we had in both of our books, and which Zara has looked at, is that there is a gap between consumer attitudes and purchasing behavior. That's Zara mentioned that before, that people will buy on price when they're actually in the store and making that actual purchase. because it relates more to self-esteem at that point in time, and the fast fashion companies have done such a good job of marketing that they allow people to overcome their social attitudes and make that purchase. But I came across a letter that indicated that back in the 1970s, I paid $29.97 for a pair of trousers, and I can easily buy a pair of trousers that I'm comfortable wearing for less than that today in actual dollars, not, you know, adjusted for inflation. And so I think, to me, it's shocking to see that we can go 40 years later and be buying a similar product for actual fewer dollars. And so somebody somewhere along the way is paying the price, just as Sarah was saying. We have not overcome this gap in purchasing intention and consumer behavior yet with the attitudinal part of it. And I guess I'd ask Zara if she has any ideas on how we can do that. My view is that consumer behavior is where we need to make the shift. I guess just maybe a naive dream of mine is I would love to have some kind of tag on every piece of clothing that you could look at and tells you who actually made that article of clothing and what's their life like. For me, I would be willing to pay a lot more for having a positive story about the person who made an article of clothing that I am going to be wearing all day long.
A lot of fashion brands will just make up that story, though, even
well,
if it's
that's
not true.
See, there you guys said naive. So that was my that was my point. But I that's what we need to overcome. I think, Zara, do you have ideas on that? How we overcome this whole issue?
There is an opinion that all this ethical consumption is communicated to consumers in very complex terms, and there many studies show that it's if the companies try to communicate it in simple terms, that is more attractive to customers. So in this way, they can increase ethical fashion consumption. So because for consumers, social norms play a very important role. The expectations of the society members are very important to customers. So if the society perceives them that they need to be fashionable, so customers would rather compromise on ethical issues and buy what is more trendy and fashionable. So if companies can try to make this connection between social norms and ethical fashion consumption, I think that this can be a way of increasing it, rather than just saying that you need to buy ethical fashion just because it is ethical.
Is anyone doing that very well right now?
Stella McCartney also. I mean, there are some brands that are positioning themselves in a quite stylish, cool manner. Stella McCartney, I would say, is an example, and she doesn't stress very much the moral point of view when she doesn't use any leather in her with her bags, but she gives it kind of a glam red carpet sort of touch. And so I think she has, for example, managed to like combine luxury and sort of celebrity stylish considerations with a very like sustainable aspect of her business that she has. And I think it's the fact is that many small ethical fashion brands don't invest much in marketing, actually. Not everybody, but a lot save money on that side because they'd rather pay higher prices to their suppliers so that they can pay higher wages and so on. And
well, even if you don't do that, you're still doing Instagram. You still have a website. Mm-hmm. What phrasing works better than what they're doing now?
I think it always works well if it sort of meets the general trends and wishes and dreams that young people have in terms of style, but also in terms of how they like to communicate, what they find attractive, and so on. So the brands that are typically successful with regard to communication are those that are exactly meet the preferences of the young generation, as I said, with regard to social media communication, the types of social media. I mean, not every small ethical fashion brand uses Instagram or so on. Yeah, some are more, let's say, traditional in the ways they communicate, or they speak a different language than the intended target group, or they use different visual tools. And I think what young people perceive as trendy is also then typically also successful, like in any other context as well.
From sourcing to consumption to post-consumption, what are the biggest obstacles in converting the existing system to be more ethical and sustainable in a global sense?
The system in a global sense.
Yeah.
Converting the system in a global sense. It has many different features.
What can we start with?
The consumer plays a strong role, but of course also I think it's a combination of actors, producers, brands, consumers, politicians, regulators, and each actor in society plays a role there. And so some people talk about sustainable transformation, and for example, with regard to governance, we currently talk a lot about what is a smart mix of governance here, meaning a combination of public regulation, but also private self-regulation, standards, initiatives, and so on. So many sort of when we discuss governance, many people think about a combination of actors that work together and to share responsibility, like also Doro Baumann-Pauli also wrote in our book from NYU here in New York, and they developed this concept of shared responsibility, where they talk about an industry transformation and what it requires. But also, and as I said, there is a clear role of consumers, and we all, I mean, each of us can ask ourselves every day, I mean, how do we consume? How much do we really need? And I'm always trying to improve my own consumer behavior a little bit. I'm quite surprised how little you actually need once you start thinking of it, and how much we actually consume and what we need and what we don't need. And I think also a recent trend when we think about other countries is also that many firms now reconsider the role of unions. It's, for example, also, I would say, one of the important results of our book. So we have, for example, a very interesting chapter by Henrik Heuermann of H&M. He's a sustainability manager there, where he argues quite strongly also for collaborative or cooperation with unions and how important local unions are. And I think they have kind of been a bit forgotten in the past somehow, or unions became less influential maybe, and in some countries they are still quite weak, unfortunately.
It's a politically polarizing word here in the United States, certainly. The idea of a union puts mm-hmm. people on one side or the other,
yes,
in a political
mm-hmm.
argument.
And then, like, in some countries there are some unions, but they are sometimes quite weak or suppressed and so on. And I think after we had a couple of years where we thought the companies have to make sure that certain standards like labor rights are fulfilled along their supply chain, and they try to enforce this via auditing and trainings and capacity building and so on, there is currently a trend towards more supporting local institutional structures and especially the unions, because you talked about democracy also before. One idea is, of course, that the local actors should be much more involved in sort of articulating their own interest and so on, but of course also enabled and empowered. And I think the unions play a core role in this whole, let's say, transformation towards more justice.
You know, I think, kind of coming at what Sarah's saying a little bit differently, The word social movement was used earlier, I think, in the discussion, Sarah. I think you mentioned that. And I look at it from a social movement perspective. In other words, in the United States, we had a social movement, essentially, that started against smoking in the 1960s. And it took a period of decades before it really had a major impact. And it now has had a lasting impact in the United States. Then, you know, about 20 years ago, 15 years ago, there was a social movement that started regarding food. And there has been, not although it's not complete, there's been a major change in terms of major brands wanting to address organic food because consumers have wanted it. How did that happen? I think there was a social movement that kind of bubbled up and demanded it, and it was manifested in a variety of ways, and quite often there are cataclysmic events that occur that kind of become flashpoints. And I think, you know, if you look at the fast fashion industry, Rana Plaza was a flashpoint type of event, in my view, that is really catapulting the issue, so that is a social movement that's lasted about the problems of fast fashion production. And so in my view, we're heading towards a stage where there will be a broader public insistence on having more sustainable fashion. We're not there yet, but I think we can look at the past examples that I've given and say, yes, that can happen. And yes, we have had a cataclysmic event so that other people will look at other events and it will become politically charged to the point that the major brands will start to get out there to compete against each other on sustainability. So we already see H&M, for example, with their fashion conscious brand. Now, whether or not that's real or semi-real, I don't know. But that's an example of something that's being done that wasn't done 20 years ago when fast fashion was kind of started. So that's kind of my take on it. And again, I may be naive and overly positive about the future, but that's how I look at it.
Well, going back to the same question, what are the big obstacles? What has to change for the whole system to change?
Well, you know, I think the major brands, you know, like H&M, Zara, those are two big ones. They compete head to head for business in terms of market share, and market share is a big driver of their profit. And so they are constantly looking for signs that somewhere in their supply chain they may have a weakness that they need to address so they can make sure that they have the lowest cost. And this is why we were talking about Myanmar and about Ethiopia. It's this issue of you have to constantly be looking for a lower cost because of the search for higher market share in order to satisfy shareholders on a quarterly basis. And my point would be then, for example, when you look at the food industry, you still have Walmart that's the big gorilla in the room when it comes to market share for food, but you now have Walmart along with Kroger, along with other brands that have entire aisles of sustainable food. And that is tangible. And so I think that that once again, that's what it's going to come down to, is that large fast fashion brands will have to see that the business model that they have in place is not sustainable. And we've seen other brands in fashion come and go. For example, Gap was the darling, 15 years ago or so. They've struggled. So there is this shift in consumers that you know that they can be willing to make change. And it's just, I think it just hasn't sunk into the psyche of people yet because of how effective the fast fashion brands have marketed themselves. But I think it will.
So it sounds like it's time. That's what we need. It's really a matter of time because we know the truth. The truth has been exposed and it's got to go through a process, I guess.
I think it's not just time because we've had so much time already, and like how much more time do we need for why? So I think it is it requires really a shift in paradigms also, in for different actors, starting with the businesses maybe. I think we really have to consider how we view what we think the role of businesses actually are in society, and. We should start reconsidering the growth paradigm, for example. Like, do we really, like, always only need businesses that grow and that just make more profits and cut costs and so on? Like, the whole approach of businesses, basically, and what are the motives there and what is the contribution, basically, that business can give bring to society. Of course, businesses have a lot of positive contributions as employers and also like because they offer the products that we have here. But I think the strong growth pressure is a major barrier and the whole shareholder-based capitalism. But also when we look at governments, there are still a lot of governments all over the world that don't do their job well with regard to safeguarding human rights, and it's sometimes very unclear to me why certain governments just don't act more as a guardian of human rights also in the field of businesses. But again, also we the consumers, and I think this is also a paradigmatic thing. Maybe we really also need to reconsider our value system and. Why do we always need to have more? And I'm very often overwhelmed also here in New York when I go into all these malls. And I was at Uniqlo yesterday because I the day before yesterday because I urgently needed something against the rain, and it was just around the corner, and I was just overwhelmed by how much textiles were just in this store, in this huge store, and it's just one of the stores, I think on Fifth Avenue. And why do we need all this? And why do we always need new things? And for every party, why do we always need a new outfit? And so on. So I think we need to really reconsider where we get our self-esteem from and what we value and what defines our identity. I still believe that consumers have strong influence and strong power, but it's not just learning about ethical matters or more transparency in the supply chain. It's really about fundamental value systems, I would say. And there is a misalignment there somehow that is quite a barrier, I would say, for sustainable transformation.
Yeah, I think we have to be mindful also of the influence of social media, how much that influences a particular generation of consumers. That's a factor that's here.
So both of your books are available online, right?
That's correct.
Yes. Okay. So I found an excerpt from your book, Mark, online, which is why I reached out to your publisher to get in contact with you to be on the show. And it was extraordinary, just the amount of detail and thought that had gone into the excerpt that I found online. And I would encourage our listeners to get your book because it's pretty good.
Thank
it's,
you.
It's dense information, but if ethical fashion is your business, then these are pretty important volumes to go through. Sustainable Fashion Governance and New Management Approaches is Sarah Jastrom and Anna Marie Schneider's book, also with a contribution by Zara Berberian. Did I say that right this time?
Yes.
Yes.
You said it right.
And Eco-Friendly and Fair, Fast Fashion and Consumer Behavior by Carolyn Becker-Lightfield and Mark Heuer.
Yes.
And thank you all for coming. I'll make sure that links to the books are in our show notes for the podcast. And thanks for listening.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you very much, Charles.
Thanks for coming. AmericanFashionPodcast.com is our website, AFPOD is our Twitter handle, and on Instagram we are at American Fashion Show. There's a Be a Guest form on our website. You can also give us feedback through the website, through voicemail at 646-979-8709, or by writing to info@AmericanFashionPodcast.com. We occasionally do live events, and to get on the list for free tickets to our live shows, click the live show link also on our website. American Fashion Podcast is produced by the Fashion Media Center for Mouth Media Network. Listen to our sister shows, Fashion is Your Business, Material is Your Business, and Beauty is Your Business, also on Mouth Media Network. This and other episodes are copyrighted by Open Source Business Incorporated and Mouth Media Network Incorporated, all rights reserved. Subsist, friends, remain in force, keep making things beautiful, and keep listening. I'm Charles Beckwith, and we'll talk to you again next week.